welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, the film and TV and streaming makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, and designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And of course, as you all know, I love film and I love to talk. So it's an absolute joy to every week give you a front row seat to the who, what, where, when, why, and how of movie making with all of these interviews in our weekly podcast. And of course, there's a lot more stuff that's on the website, behindthelensonline.net. Now today, I know I had teased maybe I would, you'd hear from writer-director James Nunn today talking about Hungry, but I had the good fortune to have two incredible interviews on animated shorts take place last week. One was on Tuesday and one was on Thursday. For films that are at Tribeca right now, as well as being on the festival circuit. And I just fell in love with these films, these shorts, when I watched them. One is 4 minutes and 5 seconds. The other one is 6 minutes and 3 seconds. And only I could turn each one of them into about a 30-minute, if not longer, interview. Especially with the one. It's fascinating because it's the first time in 44 and a half years I have, as a critic, of interviewing specifically an animation editor. So that's going to be in the second half of the show. But I've got great interviews for you today as we're talking all about animation and Tribeca Film Festival. And it's not just any animation, as I said. These are both world premiere animation shorts, Dear Upstairs Neighbors, and Roar. Both are animated gems led by filmmakers with a Pixar pedigree. Animation editor Sarah Affleck and writer-director Jesse Weglin, respectively. Now, first up, we're going to Roar with writer, director, editor, DP, and songwriter Jesse Weglin and his beautiful short Roar. Roar follows a neurodivergent young girl with selective mutism who, after being uprooted from Tokyo to San Francisco, now must navigate a chaotic new culture. Chaotic. Can I talk tonight? Chaotic new culture and an isolating silence by transforming her internal K-pop soundtrack into a vibrant visual language to find her place and her new Roar. Now, as you're about to hear Jesse Weglin discuss his animated short film, he highlights its visual sensory appeal and personal connection to San Francisco, which is where he lives. He and his family live. Now, the film, inspired by Weglin's wife's own move from Tokyo to the Bay Area, addresses the challenges faced by neurodivergent individuals. Now, Jesse's got 16 years at Pixar under his belt. And with that knowledge and what he worked on, a couple of my favorite Pixar films, including he was a technical director on Good Dinosaur and Arlo. I love Arlo. He also did VFX lighting on Elio, was the lighting tech on Inside Out 2, did Turning Red. Those are just some of the films that he worked on. And animation lighting, you're lighting and you're doing tech just like you're doing on a live-action film. So Jesse brings all of that with him to this film, Roar, through his company, his new company, Illumini Studios. And what he does, based on his experience, he employs a highly believable yet stylized animation style. In many ways, it reminded me of Big Hero 6. I'm just putting that out there. But here he emphasizes expressive eyes, naturalistic settings. Now, a key element of Roar which I found very interesting, is the color palette, which is directly tied to the neurodivergent spectrum and uses color as symbolism, such as red for the Golden Gate Bridge and blue for autism awareness, to enhance the believability and emotional impact of the animation. Now, an interesting visual aspect of Roar, besides the color, is the use of extreme close-ups to represent sensory overload and focus, which Jesse explains as being a deliberate choice, as the use of ECUs simulate a micro-lens camera, representing the sensory challenges faced by neurodivergent individuals. Listening to him at every turn, he left no stone unturned in making Roar a fully sensory and targeted film. Another fun element of Roar is the music, which is, it's like a little music video. There's one song, and it's a song written by Jesse that specifically matches the visuals that we're seeing. And it's in Japanese and English. And it also integrates Hawaiian instruments, a ukulele, among others, to bridge the cultural themes between the East and the West, with Hawaii being that middle bridge, quite often a stopping point in transitions. Now, the film world premiered at Tribeca on Saturday. There is an encore screening. I'm not sure when, but Roar is also on the festival circuit, with other festivals popping up down the road. But the really cool news is that Jesse's working on a feature-length Roar, along with three other projects through Illumini. Now, I strongly suggest you follow Illumini on socials and check out the studio site to keep up on all of their upcoming projects. Because based on Roar, we're going to be falling in love with a lot of Jesse's films in the futures. So, take a listen. As writer, director, editor, songwriter, and cinematographer Jesse Weglin talks about Roar. Okay, Jesse?
Hi, Debbie. How are you? Good morning.
I'm just fine. Very thrilled to be speaking with you this morning about Roar. What a sweet, sweet film.
Oh, I certainly appreciate that. Thank you for those kind words.
I mean, it just, I love the animation. It's visually sensory. I love your soft color palette that you use. Much of this, as we go through San Francisco, it reminds me a lot of Pixar's Big Hero 6.
Right? Yes, yeah. Now, I think, I mean, it is, in essence, a love letter to San Francisco. We live there. I'm raising a family there. That's our home. And so I wanted to do something that was definitely very just promotional to San Francisco because we love it so much. And we kind of hit some of the more iconic locations that are meaningful to our family. But we also did so, tastefully in the context of the film.
Yeah, I love the locations that you pick to focus on and how you present them. You really take advantage of the beauty of natural sunlight and the sun rising up over Alcatraz in the distance with the Golden Gate and everything. What was the inspiration for this short, for Roar?
Yeah. So it is, it's a personal story to our family where it is based off of my wife, who is our producer. So she grew up, born and raised in Tokyo, Japan, and as a young girl, she and her family moved to the Bay Area of San Francisco, and it was, as most moves are, it can be very traumatic, and also in our family, we have neurodivergent members, so we wanted to make this film as a testament to some of the difficulties that those communities have, and it seems like a universal story, but it's also one that's very personal to us. And this, what is the challenges that a young girl who is nonverbal, her challenges that she faces moving to a new place and having so much to say, but the inability to do so verbally?
Well, I have to say something that comes across is that this little girl is very loved, and she's very, very happy. She may be nonverbal, but she's very, very happy. And you really capture that right around like the 3:45 mark, as we see the wind in her hair and the joy on her face when the whale jumps up out of the bay. That joy just comes across so loudly. And even her new experiences of trying Mexican food and making a face when she's about to take a sip of whatever that drink is her mother just got her. It's so, I mean, kids and adults alike, if you're trying something new, you're going to make a face. So you really bring all of that to the table here. And so beautifully done. Now, how did you decide on the animation style here? Because that's key. There's so many different ways you could have gone with this animation. But this, it's naturalistic. But as I said, it's very much, it reminds me of Big Hero 6 because of the locations, the San Francisco locations. But the color palette and the softness of this animation, there's a clarity, but there's a softness. So you're not overwhelming us. You don't have harsh lines such as a pen and ink type of animation or neon, something like that. So I'm curious what led you to this particular animation style.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Thank you for asking it. So for almost 16 years, I was at Pixar as a lead technical director and senior member within lighting and the creative service department. And so I'm very familiar with the style that Pixar likes to paint in, which is highly believable, not necessarily photorealistic, but highly believable with character, with stylized characters that are simplified in some textures, but that have very expressive facial features. The eyes being the most important aspect of the face, typically. Mm-hmm. There's so much that emotes through the eyes, which for Tora, the girl who is nonverbal, is very, very important. And so I decided to go in what was the most comfortable for me at the time, which was in a style that is similar to, you know, Disney and Pixar and DreamWorks, where we can rely on a lot of the emotion from the eyes of a simplified human character, but with a very, very bright and colorful environment. And there's a great sense of believability, though, that was essential to establish. So it feels real. It feels like a place that you're familiar with, that you know, and yet it's still, everyone realizes that it is a cartoon. And as far as we took very deliberate steps to make some things blurry and other things more crisp, and incorporating depth of field so that it helps us to understand that there is depth of field, there is focus of a camera, and we incorporated the technology to allow us to do that and to play with curvy lines and this young girl's interpretation of what this all means to her.
Mm-hmm. The animation, it is, as I said, it's visually sensory. And yes, it very much, it is highly believable and it is stylized, it's polished, but there is a simplicity. So it does let the emotion come through, and be it in her eyes or her mother's eyes, both are very important because we need the mother's connection with her daughter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It's this is at the heart of it is a mother and a daughter story that is taking place. And the mother just shows this warmth and unconditional support to her daughter. And you see that throughout the whole short film, where just there's moments where the mother is just looking at her, making sure she's okay, where the daughter isn't saying anything. She's just kind of smiling but looking down, you know, until towards the end of the animation where the daughter is so comfortable that she's actually able to dance. And that's something that resonates throughout the song is this idea of wanting to dance like the Rainbow Girl. And that harkens back to an earlier scene where we see there's a mural of a woman who has an umbrella. There's a rainbow
on the brick wall. Yeah,
exactly. And then we see the other young woman in the roller skates that's just spinning and dancing. And that really means something special to Tora, the girl. And she wants to be able to be that expressive and that happy. So in that moment at the end, where she gains enough confidence and strength that she actually does the same twirl is really kind of this beautiful arc of her character.
And what's so beautiful in that scene is the richness of the nighttime blues. It's not a murky or blue-black inkiness. It's a vibrant blue, offset with those lights on the building in the background. And it is so stunning. It's rich. It's vibrant. It's loud. You know?
Thank you.
It's loud in comparison to everything else that we've seen in terms of the gradation of the color that you have. The softness of the yellows, the pinks, the blues. Even Tara, she's dressed in lavender and pink. Just, I love that final.
There's a lot of subconscious color choices in this film, you know, from the vibrancy, that color blue that's on City Hall at the end, that blue is in autism awareness. It's a very specific color, you know, so there's all sorts of little subconscious decisions that we made to in the art direction of the film to just help kind of bring little points that we're hoping to make throughout the film. But yeah, I just had such a great time making it. It was, and it probably 90% of it won't be noticed by anyone. But I love the little details.
What other details besides the color? What other colors were you very cognizant of incorporating that are key for neurodivergent, nonverbal individuals?
Yes. So besides the blue, obviously, we use a lot of strong reds. So, and Japan, red is a primary color. You know, it's on the flag. It's the rising sun flag. So we do use a lot of reds towards the beginning, and it's symbolic of the Golden Gate Bridge, where it's not just a physical bridge. It's an emotional bridge that Tora is crossing to get to this new country. So we use a whole lot of red in the beginning, and then it starts to change colors as it's naturally the progression of the day becomes from morning, early morning to kind of midday, and then all the way to the evening. So not only is it a natural kind of occurrence of time and color from the sun, it's also symbolic of leaving Japan behind and entering this new world.
Well, I have to say, I love the reds that you chose at the beginning of the film. And it's not just, we've got the red brick, we have the painting of the woman with the umbrella on the brick, but also the Chinese lanterns. I mean, we're talking, this is true Chinese red that you're using, which I love seeing. You didn't mess with it. It's a Pantone red. But something else that you do, close-up. You go with ECU's extreme close-ups on Tora's face and on various objects, such as the drink, such as the Mexican food, the taco that she's about to eat. Talk to me about using the ECU's, because in a short film like this, in a 4-minute, 5-second short like this, a lot of filmmakers are not going to go that in-depth and think that an ECU can really work to their advantage.
Yes, it was a deliberate choice. So the extreme close-ups simulating a micro lens camera so that you really are hyper-focused. We play with a lot of tilt shift camera lenses. So in those instances where there's the extreme close-ups, I wanted it to feel when someone has a sensory overload and they are trying very hard just to focus on one thing and kind of let the rest of the environment go away in order to focus. I wanted to try to represent that in those extreme close-up moments where you really are only focusing on these very specific things and the rest of the world is going to be very blurry. And that is really symbolic of individuals that sometimes have a hard time processing a lot of stimulus. And so that's the kind of the nature behind those specific artistic choices.
That stood out for me from beginning to end, Jesse. As I said, that's something that a lot of filmmakers with a 4-minute and 5-second short, they're not going to think about that. They're going to overlook that. They're just going to pop it out there and everything is going to be pretty much like a mid-2 shot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we took some risks. you know, it was, it's very deliberate, but we wanted to spend time on certain things that were kind of symbolic of how she was feeling. And unconventional, for sure. But I wanted to also test out the robustness of what we could do to tell a story, you know, put people a little bit on edge of their norms, of what they're expecting. Because in your case, exactly, you noticed it. And then you asked, why is this happening? Why are we seeing this up close? And why are we looking at, right into Tora's irises?
Yeah.
You know, as she reflects the yearbook. The yearbook, and by the way, that's a Japanese yearbook of her former life. She was remembering her old school, of where everybody is very much homogenous. Everyone is very similar looking, as a contrast to in San Francisco, this true melting pot of cultures and diversity. So we're playing on this whole comparison of society and cultures, and it's a very short. It's not that long, but it's jam packed with context.
Oh my God. From a production standpoint and a story standpoint and an emotional standpoint. I mean, you've got a trifecta here, Jesse.
Thank you.
With, you know, the detail that you have paid. What animation platform were you using to create this?
So we were using quite a few. So everything that I learned at Pixar, we tried to incorporate. So using everything from early sketching on charcoal. We did some watercolor exploration for the skies. I went into Photoshop. I used 2D things in Photoshop that helped build some of the sets that you see. And then I actually did some of the character design in 3D using like Maya, which is a pretty standard 3D software. And then we integrated a hybrid AI. So we used many different, probably five or six different off-the-shelf AI platforms and tried them out to see what they were capable of doing to do in between animations from keyframes that I established, and then with varying degrees of success. Some of them were better than others, but we used it as a way to become very efficient in the animation process, not in the creative process, but just the between frame animation process.
How long did it take you to make this?
This entire film took about a year. So from first initial drawings, writing the script, writing the lyrics for the song. So it took about a solid year to make this entire thing, which, you know, it's a fair amount of time for an individual, but because of the efficiency of the pipeline that I created, that's relatively fast for this level.
It's relatively fast for anything, Jesse, let's face it. in this day and age. And now,
yes.
You wrote the song?
Yes. So my wife, she helped with the Japanese portions of it to help the authentic kind of language choice. But the lyrics were based on my own song that I wrote. And then we edited it very closely so that it hits the milestones of the song tempo and the specific words in the lyrics so that she's feeling those feelings as the song naturally progresses.
I'm like, where the heck did this song come from? Because it's matching, it's matching what we're seeing. It's matching her joy. It's matching new experiences. And I love the integration of the Japanese and the English.
Mm-hmm. And we you know, made a very conscious choice to incorporate Hawaii song music as well. The ukulele plays a part in the song because if you think about from a, you know, a geographical location, Hawaii is right in the middle.
Yep.
Right? So so we very purposely put Hawaiian instruments in there as a bridge. Again, this idea of a bridge between two lands and two cultures. So that's why ukulele is in there so prominently, is because for us, Hawaii is this stepping stone between the two cultures.
Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you paid attention to the instrumentation as well.
Right.
So many times that gets overlooked. And I always love going back to Brian Tyler and what he did with Yellowstone and now what he's doing with Dutton Ranch. Instrumentation is so key to Brian's compositions. And something like Yellowstone, you can really distinguish and you can hear a lot of the different Native American instrumentation that pops up in there. And here, you know, bringing in the ukulele, very important that's just another sensory level that you're bringing to this short of Roar.
Yeah.
So now that you're getting ready for your world premiere on Saturday at Tribeca, are you going?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yeah, I'm in New York right now. My family is here joining us. We're just thrilled. So, yeah, we have it's the North American premiere of the film. Just absolutely thrilled to be in the spotlight of this tremendous festival. It's such an honor and a privilege to be here amongst some of the most amazing filmmakers and talent you'll ever see. So to be here with them, no matter the outcome, we are just so thrilled that it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, I've got to ask you then, now that you have this short under your belt, on top of all the tech stuff and lighting stuff that you did while you were at Pixar, and which, by the way, Good Dinosaur is still one of my all-time Pixar faves. I love Arlo dearly.
Yes.
And the fact that, Pixar used three of my pull quotes on the TV ads, that helps. But now that you have this short under your belt, as a filmmaker, as writing, directing, doing the music, editing, cinematography, obviously, with your lighting background, what is next? What did you learn doing this that hopefully you will take forward into future directorial efforts?
Yes. Well, we're in the process of writing a feature treatment for Roar right now, and I'm very excited about that. I've finished three additional short films that are in various film festivals around the world. We are just moving forward at lightning pace. So there's so many stories that I would love to tell. And this is the perfect opportunity to continue to do so with this platform, with my new studio. I think it's very exciting. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be able to do so. What I hope Tribeca will allow, what I've learned by making the film, is really the challenges of being an independent filmmaker, of wearing so many different hats, being both behind the computer and also in front of the camera now. It's a unique position that I find myself in, but one that I'm fully embracing. I think being able to bring people back to work, I'm hopeful that as we gain more notoriety and success, that we'll be in a position to hire more people at the studio and help the animation industry maybe form something that's very, very positive for everyone.
Boy, that would be a blessing in disguise here, Jesse, in today's climate, cinematic climate. But I am excited that you've got three other projects already out there in various stages, and hopefully we'll see a feature for Roar down the road. But I cannot wait. I can't wait to see the other films that you've already done. Just seeing Roar, I'm very excited. This is an amazing calling card for you, Jesse.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I agree. I agree 100%. I don't take for granted one moment of it. I know it's extraordinarily rare to get a film into Tribeca, especially the first film you make. And I don't take any of it for granted. I'm incredibly humbled by this entire opportunity and experience. I can't wait to continue to make films. I'm very fortunate that we have this studio, that we don't have a tremendous amount of people that are telling us no. So there's no huge return on investment strategy that makes us conservative in what stories we have to tell. When there's a good story that we feel passionate about, we're going to make it. And that means it could be a neurodivergent girl, or it can be someone with Alzheimer's. It's stories that need to be told by individuals, and people that are passionate about animation.
And who do it so elegantly.
Thank you.
It's beautiful. It's elegant. I love it. And I can't wait to see more from you, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Yes, me too. Thank you, Debbie. I look forward to that opportunity for sure. A good way for anyone who's interested, IlluminaiStudios.com is a great kind of hub for us. We're also on a lot of social media platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. So for anyone who's interested in following our journey towards making more films, feel free to check us out.
Oh, my God. Well, I'll definitely check out the company site. That's for darn sure. Oh, Jesse, thank you so much. And have a wonderful time at Tribeca tomorrow. And good luck. The audience is going to love this. They're going to love it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jesse. Bye-bye.
Bye, Debbie. See you.
And that was Jesse Weglin discussing his animated short film, Roar. Now, for more information on Roar and Jesse's other projects, go to IlluminaiStudios.com. That's I-L-L-U-M-I-N-A-I Studios.com. And you get the skinny on everything he's working on, where Roar is going, what festivals it's going to be in, and these other three projects he's working on. So exciting. And it's a beautiful, beautiful short film. Now, some more animation goodness for you from animation editor Sarah Affleck and Dear Upstairs Neighbors. Now, Dear Upstairs Neighbors is the fantastical and all too relatable story of one woman's epic battle against her noisy neighbors for a good night's sleep. As I told Sarah, this short from director Connie Hee could directly pertain to my condo neighbors, and I'm betting some of your neighbors too. Now, Connie Hee, a Pixar alum, and her crew had assistance from Google DeepMind's custom video generation models to craft the saturated spectacle. And this is after a blend of other animation elements. Now, Sarah Affleck, an animation editor and director who also came from Pixar, where she worked on Elemental and Netflix. She worked on Wendell and Wild, which I love that film, among others, smartly mirrors the quote-unquote gonzo style of the animation and story with playful rapid edits, bringing even more feisty fury to the short's key battle scenes. And trust me, these are battle scenes as poor woman is trying to sleep, and it is impossible. I really do think that Connie, when she was writing this, that she had to have been, like, spying on my condo complex. So, because it is colorful, it's rapid fire, it intensifies with sound, with music, just sound mixer, music god Mark Needham handled that. But everything on this, as Sarah talks about at length, everything was so collaborative with everybody having input into every aspect of the production. So I had the privilege of speaking with animation editor Sarah Affleck on Thursday, just before the Tribeca Film Festival world premiere of Dear Upstairs Neighbors. And as I mentioned at the top, over the past 44 and a half years, this is the first time I've spoken with an animation editor. And you edit animation a lot differently than live action. And what an interview it turned out to be. As you're about to hear, Sarah delves deep into Dear Upstairs Neighbors and goes beyond just editing, as given the collaborative nature of Connie's vision, everyone could weigh in on every element. And for an editor, that involves images, color saturation, sound, and music. Now, as you're going to hear Sarah discuss, she highlights the film's meticulous pacing, which was musically informed, and the use of sound to create a cacophonous effect. She emphasizes the collaborative process with Connie and the importance of technology in enhancing the creativity. And that's the key. Technology enhances the creativity. It does not replace it. The film, which took 2 years to produce, features traditional animation techniques and a dynamic sound mix, courtesy of Mark Needham. Now, on board with the production from early on, Sarah had extensive input from early storyboarding to finding pacing to timing, editing cuts and style, to the beat and meter of the music, to the intimate process of animation editorial where music and sound effects are integrated from the start. And that's what's really different from live action editing, to the final edit and more. thus ensuring the film's narrative and visual elements aligned seamlessly. This really is a truly fascinating interview. So take a listen. I think it's close to 40 minutes, people. I'm just warning you. So take a listen as animation editor Sarah Affleck discusses Dear Upstairs Neighbors. It's so fun. So let Sarah and I dive into this little gem.
Go for it.
This to me, I will tell you, Sarah, and all the people I've interviewed, the thousands of people over the decades, you are the first animation editor that I have been lucky enough to speak with.
Oh my God, I'm so honored.
So, I mean, I love the short. It is so much fun. I'm watching it, and all I kept thinking is, my God, does Connie know my upstairs neighbor?
I think we all have
I'll tell you. I mean, the animation is so true to life. Howling dog, high heels clomping, elephant jumping rope, army boot, bowling balls rolling on the floor. I swear to God, the guy who owns the condo above me is doing all of that. I swear. In addition to playing an electric guitar, the same four bars over and over again at 2 o'clock in the morning every night.
Oh, no.
So, I totally get this and the hilarity in it. But one of the great things about Dear Upstairs Neighbor, Sarah, is its pacing. Pacing comes down to you.
Yes, it does.
The pacing is just perfect. And the way that this is cut and put together so that we get a sequence and then we go to black and you hold the black for a couple of seconds just so we get that idea that, oh, it's quiet. I can sleep now. No, that doesn't happen because then you hit us again and it gets more cacophonous and louder. So I love how you have edited this short because of the connective tissue that pacing creates. So that is just so brilliant. Brilliantly done, Sarah. I love it.
I genuinely, that moves me to hear that, to be honest. I've worked a long time in this industry, and I come at, you know, my own cuts with a specific creative flair. And I'll tell you, like, you know, Dear Upstairs Neighbors was a very musically informed film. Like, me and Connie were literally sitting in edit, timing the beats and the meter of every cut. And a lot of what I would try to, like, talk to her about is, like, you know, the pacing of the film in particular really requires a very specific meter because it's so, you know, sound-based. Like, she doesn't have any lines of dialogue. What is the character and how do we show that there's an antagonist here? And I felt like one of the best ways to do that was with using, like, we'd literally be in the edit booth counting meter, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, like 4/4, and just trying to kind of create something that grips our audience, and I'm really happy to hear that translated to you, and I hope that it also translates to the viewers when they watch it. You know, it's important to me that edit and story become like music being composed. You know, it's just the way that I approach all filmmaking that I do. You know,
well,
so, yeah.
It's particularly important with an animated short like this because this, for all intents and purposes, you could actually say this is a mini music video because it is, it's codependency between the music and the imagery. And I have to say, I love the fact, I can just picture you and Connie there, you know, counting, especially when we get to the sequence where hell explodes in a cacophony of sound and color with the death metal music and the speakers, and it's pulsing and the speakers pulsing, and poor Ada is like pulling her hair out and screaming and ready to punch that hole in the sky into the sky, which immediately made me think of Freddie Mercury. Mm-hmm. So you've got great touchstones, but it is this, the music, the beat is so key, and I see how you use that with your editing. And that is so smart on your part. You know, very well done to do that.
Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, I definitely, you know, it's funny. I recall now even just like when we were running through that sequence in the boards, like, you know, the first track I actually put in the music because, you know, occasionally when you're cutting storyboards and animation, you know, you'll put your own sound effects and music in there just as temp tracks. And, you know, the first track I put in there was Slayer's Raining Blood. And I was like, okay, Connie, I need you to just go with me on this. I just need you to, you know, this first version, you're not going to, it's not going to make much sense, but we're just go with us. you know, and it turned out to be something that she really responded to. And, you know, animation editorial is really a special process because of the fact that it's such an intimate space, you know.
Yeah.
With live action directing, you know, you kind of get, you know, editors have started to become a greater part of that process and informing the shots and the cuts and the way we complete our edits. But in animation, we craft all of it from the ground up. And,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's so special that, you know, Connie was open to a lot of my ideas with music and I think that informs the heart of the short, you know, of like, when you see Ada's performance, it's such a relatable story. You know, every creative I know has had a experience like this where, you know, you got these neighbors who are making horrible noise. You know, I think when I had one when I was working at Pixar years ago, like I lived in a communal space and, you know, my downstairs neighbors were having massive parties at 4 a.m. and I'm like, shut up, you know? And I think that just like, you know, we wanted to really add an aspect of this film of relatability, but then also an aspect of like the film starts very methodical and slow and quiet. And then as she, you know, as her emotional states, Ada's emotional states get more and more amplified, we start amplifying the art style. We start amplifying the sounds. We start amplifying the cuts. Everything becomes frenetic until at the end when she explodes. And that's, you know, That whole frenetic cutting pace was just something that I was very adamant about in the editorial process. Like, just, hey, we need to keep amping up and up and up and up. So, it really, every time you say that, it feels like a validation of all of these ideas. I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
We're communicating things.
Sarah, all of your ideas, everything that you're telling me, I'm seeing it here. And it is very relatable. And I'm curious, how early did you get involved with this? Because I know you've worked on some big animation projects before. Wendell and Wild, which I love. I love that one with Netflix. And of course, Elemental, which I still think it was very underrated by a lot of people because what we really got to see was the advancement with the animation in terms of refraction, reflection, transparency, opaqueness, and all of that is beautifully cut together when we, you know, with the water and transitioning and whatnot. You have had an incredible training ground and developing your visions, your style, your techniques. So to see you get to do this yourself with Dear Upstairs Neighbors is very exciting. But I'm curious, how early did you get involved with Dear Upstairs Neighbors? Were storyboards done and they come to you, Connie comes to you or the producers come to you and say, hey, Sarah, you want to edit this? What is this process on how early you got into this?
Well, you know, it's really funny. It's a funny story. I obviously worked with Marcia and Connie at Pixar years ago, and Dear Upstairs Neighbors came on my radar in like 2024 around there, where, you know, they were working on a short film, and Marcia and me would have lunches and talk about the short films we're working on. I was working on a short film at the time, and so we were just passing ideas back and forth, and then when we all left Pixar in 24, you know, I stayed in touch with Marcia and, you know, just chatting with her, and she said, "Hey, we got picked up, and there's a possibility that this is that there's opportunity here." And so I had already seen the first storyboard cuts that Connie had done. Connie was working on it by herself at that point, and then when it came to Google, I introduced a lot of my own ideas at a lunch with her, and then received an email back and was like, "Hey, do you want to be a part of this?" And so I started, very close to the beginning, not necessarily at the beginning, mm-hmm. but very close to the beginning of that idea when Google got it, became a part of this and started supporting and enabling this project to become a real thing. Because, it's like you work so hard to create something to show someone as a singular artist on the project. And then, when other people become involved in it to enable it to become like, an actual movie, it's exciting to see that process occur. And I'm so grateful to Marcia and Connie for, bringing me on and just being able to stay in touch as fellow creatives, because I feel like we did a lot of amazing things on this film that were very early on in our conversations together, ideas that we could only dream of at Pixar, and then we took them into the real world, and Google made that possible. Like, it just was so awesome to see. So yeah, I started very early on, it's been like almost a 2-year project now for me.
Wow, for a six minute and 13-second short. 2 years. This explains why most animated films take a filmmaker 10 years to get it made.
Oh, it's very true. Yeah. I mean, at its most conservative production timeline, even feature films for animation features, take 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
And Elemental started in 3 different presidencies. So, it is something that, animation is a crafted art form that takes time, dedication, and true artistry, and technology enables that to a certain extent, but ultimately it is this handcrafted feel, and we accomplished all of that on Dear Upstairs Neighbors to a degree that I'm just astounded by every time I watch it. I mean, even yesterday I was running through some of the pinball sequences and I was like, God, we accomplished some of this stuff, so it's just I'm so excited for how animation is constantly evolving.
I love animation. I love traditional animation. What I love about Dear Upstairs Neighbors is, yes, you've got all of the AI compliments, everything that Google can bring to it, but at its heart, it's traditional animation. It very much is the pen and ink and magic marker style of the 1960s.
Absolutely.
And I love that. I mean, I'm one of these people. I'm 68 years old, and on Saturday mornings, I will still turn the TV on to watch MeTV tune in with me cartoons at 7 in the morning. I love animation. But to see this and see that it is very traditional in its design and in the structure, you've definitely got a Bugs Bunny kind of thing happening here. You got a Looney Tunes thing happening, Sarah.
It's true. I think that, Connie had a very particular vision, and obviously we have a lot of flexibility and control in animation in a way that you don't necessarily have in live action. And I think that, like I said, technology can certainly enable a lot more to the process as an additive. You can always add more in, but you can't necessarily take it back out. Like, the true heart of this film is in the artistry and the human-led creativity of, like, sitting in dailies with some of the animators, like, talking through, just the ways in which Ada's going to react to this sound, and, like, when a gong hits her in the head, she's going, whoa, 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 kind of. That stuff can't be replicated by, it can't necessarily be something that technology is gonna come up with initially. Like, it's something that, like, we sat together in rooms and hashed out, and I think that's what's so special. Is like, one of the things that I worked with on Connie on this is, how do we develop a new visual language, like, mm-hmm. for filmmaking? And technology enabled us to, and certainly
artificial intelligence and other tools enabled that to occur, for us to have conversations at a faster, at the speed of our imagination. Like, you know, but at the core of it was our human-led imagination, the artistry of people coming together from diverse backgrounds. Like, you know, seeing Cassie's, you know, our animation director's background, you know, he's How Do You Train Your Dragon at DreamWorks. Like, this guy has worked on huge features and uncertainly Glenn, you know, and so many of the people involved in this project have worked on tons of animation projects and bring such a wealth, an embarrassment of riches in terms of talent and animation credibility. And so, you know, when you bring that together, I mean, it's like bringing the best ingredients together for, you know, a stew of awesomeness. And so, you know, certainly technology makes our conversations easier, but, you know, we utilize a lot of our own tastes and personal wants. And I brought that in my editorial style. I was like, you know, especially the sequence where we're seeing the heartbeat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that was me going back and forth, passing ideas with Connie, but a lot of it was also initiated by me where I was like, you know, hey, we can go from darkness to this, to, you know, to this transition of the brain coming outside of her head and then going back and slapping back into her face. And, you know, and you know, being able to, like, utilize tools to visualize that in a quicker way for Connie. Like, I don't think a lot of people realize how much actually happens in the edit reviews with directors. Like, you know, I am sitting in there actually comping things together and visualizing using the latest assets we have. So animation, our animators would send us animation. I would cut that up and, you know, split it into layers, and we'd be able to do more and more transitions and things with it. And then, you know, certainly that would inform, like, the way that Connie thinks, and she filters that through, you know, her directorial taste and vision. But ultimately, we're sitting there, like, hashing out, you know, hours at a time, just these kind of comedic bits. And how do we use and leverage technology or the support of other kind of, you know, technologies and models to leverage that new vocabulary. In a way that is human-centered, in a way that respects the artists and their ability to create things at the speed of their imagination.
Brought up a scene that I dearly love, and it's the brain exploding, and it's Fast and Furious and the pinball machine. I got the biggest kick out of that. But I'm curious, you get scenes like that, or you get the heart scene, you know, the pump, pump, pump. Are you getting finished animation cells or, you know, designs from the animators, or do you have input and get to work with the animators to possibly tweak the animation so it fits more of your idea for a cleaner edit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I love most about animation editorial is, like, you know, as an editor, I get to start crafting the intention of a shot, you know, with the director from the storyboard phase. Like, I can sit here and be like, at every animation level, we do layout, you know, we'll do rough draft animation, any kind of previs, any kind of, like, you know, every single stage of the animation process, I am refining my cut. So, you know, we have this joke in animation where, like, you don't just cut the movie once, you cut it 1,000 times. I think I even told the crew this when we finished the film, like, this film is made up of 1,000 tiny decisions that we all made together, and that's what's so special about, you know, being on a movie, even a short, you know, an animation project of any size is a behemoth. It is a massive ship to be steered, of any size. And so, you know, working in edit, we do our best to maintain the purity of intention when you draw something on a piece of paper and you animate that. You know, animators would send me all of their in-progress cuts as they came in. You know, I was receiving, like, hundreds of assets daily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the end of it, our project size was just absolutely massive because, you know, you aren't just, like, you aren't just generating finished things. You have to inform, like, hey, the eyebrow here is tweaked a little too high. Yeah, we want to accentuate the arms a little bit here. Can we also, like, you know, get the running speed a little quicker? And then, like, you know, just things like that, like thousands of tiny decisions. And I would sit in dailies and be like, hey, well, this is how those decisions relate to this cut going forward. Here, let's bring up the cut. ways in which, you know, a shot goes, starts, pays, and sets up and pays off, you know, and in three-shot, four-shot increments, this is how we're building this film piece by piece, you know, because that is what tells a story. You know, three, four shots at a time, you know, in the kind of broader scope of 250,000 frames, you know, that is what tells a story, is these thousands of tiny decisions. And I think that's what was such a joy to feel like, you know, there was limitless possibilities available to us. You know, we could do anything we wanted in edit. And I made that very clear to Connie. I was like, this film can be anything you want it to be. You have a very direct idea of where you want to go. But, you know, editors and animation are kind of like, you know, confidants for directors. We get to bounce ideas back and forth. And certainly she, you know, she has her own perspective that she, you know, lends to it. But I always like to emphasize to people, like, animation can be whatever you make it. It's whatever you draw on the page, whatever you animate, it can be anything you want.
And God bless Crayola and their box of 64 colors. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Did you have any input into the color at all with the animators? Because I love the color, how we go from the more subdued blue with the little desk light, and then as poor Ada is trying to sleep, each noise has a different color. And it intensifies as we're working our way up to death metal hell. So, did you have any input or suggestions on the color? Because the color also, for me anyway, it also goes hand in hand with pacing of edit. Because obviously you don't want something, the Fast and Furious Flaming Hell, too early. Or you don't want it too intense, so it's going to overshadow another nuanced element. So I'm just curious if you had any recommendations or input into the colors that were used.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly I obviously, you know, as just someone who is a loud creative voice in general, I am very outspoken about my own opinions, and I gave a lot of, you know, I had a lot of input as far as, like, you know, hey, so this is how we're pacing the film, just not just auditorially but visually. And you know, obviously perspectives, when you work on a movie, like, you kind of mix a lot of perspectives and egos together, and you don't get every decision you want, but, like, you ultimately make your voice heard. And I think that is something that I feel was so special in this production process, was just the fact that, you know, we nothing we ever brought to the table was personal. Like, everything was, like, you know, in service of this film. Like, hey, we are all trying to do something great here. We are all trying to tell a really awesome story. And if you don't like my idea, that's great. No offense taken. There's no egos here. Like, it's literally just a process of, like, what is in service to Ada's story. And you know, I definitely had feelings more specifically about the end, and definitely was happy to see those reflected, you know, in a way, because at the end of the day, like, you know, you want to be honest about what is going to read to an audience. An audience is going to experience a movie way differently than you have in your mind when you were creating it. Like, and I think that was the perspective that I always tried to come to edit reviews with, to dailies with, to the production process with, is, like, how is our audience going to experience the film? How how does that relate to how are we trying to, you know, what are we trying to make together? Because it's, you know, you obviously don't want to make a movie, you know, in service to entirely to an audience, but from a color perspective, you know, when we're in the DI rooms and stuff, like, you want something that feels tactile and feels creatively lived in and correct to the universe you're creating. So especially that'll reflect instantly in the cut. If any shot is off, or if any, you know, one single frame is out of place, it is instantly read by an audience, instantly read by me, and I just try to, like, push that as often as I can. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to ask you about, because I, as I mentioned before, I love the moments where you cut to black. and you give us a couple seconds of respite. Was that, how did you decide where to put those black cuts and how long to hold them? Because that's really important, especially because then we have a sequence where there's actually some slow motion there in the almost white on white where Ada, an attempt at REM sleep, peaceful sleep. So I'm curious about choosing those black moments and holding those before coming back in to the next cycle of noise hell.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is just like it's pure psychology. You know, we're trying to, you know, I think there was a statistic that I read a long time ago around how you know viewers who watch movies are, you know, you have 14 frames. To get their interest in something before they scroll onto something next. And, you know, I think that ultimately we wanted to toe that line where we were trying to lull an audience into a sense of security where we're like, okay, we're slowing the phone down now. No. We got, like, metal and everything. Ah! You know, there's... And I think that's how I approached a lot of these, like, spaces where they're small vignettes throughout her night. And, you know, we had... In earlier conversations talked about like a previous version of the film, which was like one continuous moment throughout the night. But then, you know, I kind of had made the point and we had conversations about the fact that like splitting it up and making it feel longer and making it feel like she is really not able to get through this night so that by the time the end comes about, you know, it feels like we all have lived through her sleepless night. You know, and so ultimately, I would just sit there and edit, like looking at black for long periods of time. I'm like, okay, you know, 10 beats here. Nope, we got to do 250 more frames, 250 more frames. Like, you know, because we need the audience to feel like they're still invested in the picture,
mm-hmm.
they're still invested in the story, but at the same time, we need to make sure that their nervous system when they're watching it is primed for what we're about to bring them. And I think that that is so important how a viewer watches and experiences a film, especially if you're in the theater, you know, and I'm so excited to see this in the theaters and how it plays to an audience. You know, it's just like you want to make sure that they are invested in your story long enough to get hit with whatever you're showing them. And you know, and it all goes back to like setups and payoffs. Like, we're setting up this concept that she is trying to sleep. So how do we pay it off? Well, we lull people in with small, you know, clues of black, thinking we're going to dreamland, and then no, we're shocked back to reality. So, I mean, like I said, I pace it, you know, with meter and timing and things like that. But ultimately, it talks about psychology at a deep level.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious because you know we briefly touched on the music aspect of this, but I'm curious because I love the sound mix on here, the sound mix and edit. And I know Mark Needham was the lead sound mixer on this because the sound mix and the volume that we're hearing is directly in tandem with the editing pace.
Yeah, I mean, like, first of all, Mark Needham, absolutely massive legend.
Yeah.
Working with someone who has crafted albums for the Fleetwood Mac and just so many huge acts, like the laundry list of people he's worked with over the years. And I think it was an important conversation that we started off with early on was like, you know, sound is our lead character on this movie. You know, it is the thing that drives our story forward. It's thing that we relate to the most. How do we how do we craft a mix and music, and how do we relate that conversation to you know just the story that we're trying to tell? And I'm you know obviously very happy that you know Mark's mix really reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
You know and our composer Young Spielberg, like just the music that he's crafted, just absolutely speaks perfectly to this. And I think that my conversations with a lot of them from editorial are mostly from a position of like, you know, clinically, this is how our cut's coming together. this is where our beats are. This is where my cuts are starting. And, you know, here's how they've shifted. Because, you know, we start conversations with them very, you know, before the film's ever finished. And so I'll be sending them updated cuts throughout the process and, you know, saying, okay, well, we're shifting the emotional beats of this thing right here. You know, this is how this shot has shifted in this sequence. We're moving things around in this way. And then, you know, it's always kind of a collaborative process. I mean, obviously, what am I going to tell Mark that he doesn't already know, because he's such a legend. And, you know, and so for me, like, I'm not going to, and same with young Spielberg, like, you know, I'm going to tell them my ideas and, but also they're going to bring a lot of their own talent to this and run with it. So the best you can hope for is like, this is the story we're telling, you know, and we're trying to go for it. Here's what my cut contributes to that, and how you add to that process is truly your artistry. So, you know, I'm in love with everything they did on this project, and I'm so happy that they were open to the kind of collaborative process that you know is very, you know, is essential to creating a animated movie, especially when you're, you know, creating something from nothing. So, yeah.
Because I have to say, what I really appreciated with the sound mix and the volume is there is a differential. There's a variance within the volume at different points of the film. It's like the volume goes up exponentially for our death metal speakers from hell. And it's actually much louder than the full-blown Octopus Party. Because the Octopus Party it's really interesting, the music for that brief segment, that little snip.
Yeah.
And it's actually softer than the death metal speaker sequence. So, you know, I love how this is so nuanced down to that. And that sound, the sound levels really match with your cuts.
Yeah. I mean, like, we're going in it, you know, a lot of this film is like oscillating between reality and non-reality.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of conversations about like, okay, well, we want to end the film in a certain perspective, and we want to add this opportunity for us to see what from the perspective of the neighbors, the upstairs neighbors, like what they've been doing. And obviously, it's not as loud inside of their apartment as so much as it is inside of Ada's head,
right?
You know, and Ada's amplified reality, you know, or kind of imagined reality when we're inside her head. Massive, and I think that it was important to like cut us back again, going back to like that idea of like, you know, we're playing with an audience's, like priming an audience's nervous system when we're cutting a film together, and how do we shock them for a second till we come back to reality, and then lull them, and then oh no, you know, massive explosion, and I think that really sets up and pays off in a lot of really great ways. So I think the sound is definitely an important aspect of telling the story in a way that an audience feels like they're on a ride, you know, not necessarily like entirely some theme park ride, but like
right.
that they are being pushed through stages of a film. Like, you know, you know, there's this theory about writing that I really love, that like the South Park writers do it a lot. It's like, this happens, therefore this happens, but this happens. It's like replacing, you know, this with therefore and but and I think that I approach my edit style the same way. Like, I'm like, this happens, but this happens, therefore this happens, but this happens, and I think that like the sound contributes to that in a major way in this film. I mean, it'd be different if we had dialogue, but certainly we want to amp up because the sound is such a huge player in this film.
Yeah. And it's clear that there's a synergy between your editing and the sound, not just the sound design and the score, but the mix, Mark's mix of it. And it just works so beautifully, Sarah. Because you've been around a while, you've done live action, you worked on major feature animation projects. What would you say in terms of making Dear Upstairs Neighbors, what would you say is the greatest technological advancement that aided you as an editor in bringing this story to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I think it goes back to just the ways in which we form our conversation. Like the ways in which I can visualize something using, you know, the technology that I had at my disposal to preview something for a director, and just being able to create at the speed of my imagination and thought. You know, I think that the thing that's always held back editors, creatives of all kinds, is just the time it takes to actually bring something to life. And that, and that's not to say that that is a bad part of the process. It's just a part of the process that, like, what ideas are you leaving on the cutting room floor? Some things get left behind because you forget about them. And we didn't really necessarily have that in this process where, you know, we were able to utilize technology in a way where we were able to create at the speed of our thoughts. And I think that developing that creative language was incredibly important. Like, I trust my nonlinear editor software. I've used enough of it across multiple features. You know, I've cut at least 6 theatrical features at this point, you know, cut on and supported or just worked in this animation, in this industry for almost like 15 years now. So, like, I trust the technology behind me. But it's the thing that hinders us always the most is the ability to talk to one another and create a vocabulary. Like, when you work with someone new, you're making a new language and shorthand that you have to use with one another. And I think the thing that the technology on this film allowed us to do the most was just create that vocabulary at a quicker speed than I've ever been able to have with another director. You know, some directors are, you know, they still look for their voice and how to communicate their ideas to an editor. An editor is the same way. And the people that work around them. And I think that the thing that I utilize is just, you know, what is additive to the process, what is adding to my abilities and augmenting my abilities to facilitate a conversation about a story we're trying to tell. And so, yeah, I mean, I used Adobe products on this. I used Google products on this. I used so many technologies in conjunction with one another. But again, they add to the process. They augment my ability. But at the end of the day, it's what's helping me craft a conversation in a creative way. You know.
Now, I have to ask you, Sarah.
Yeah.
You know, you've done live action. You've done animation. Just hearing your voice, your passion for animation, is off the charts. You are like John Lasseter talking about animation and hand-drawn. So I'm curious, what is it about animation that drives you, that you love so much, that makes you keep working on animated films?
You know, I think it's the boundless potential and the varied perspectives of the people that you work with, you know. I don't think that there has ever been a better time for me to be good at what I do, and I always try to approach any of my filmmaking efforts with this perspective of how can I enable people who have not necessarily had stories told before or never felt like they've had a voice to tell stories. Animation is the great, you know, leveling field of all of that, in enabling people who have a diverse array of voices. Now, their ability to access resources is a different conversation, but certainly the thing that, you know, gets me out of bed in the morning, the thing that brings me back to animation, is the fact that, like, you know, we get to craft anything we want from the blank page, and we get to bring that to life at 24 frames a second, and then we get to be the thing that moves, you know, moves imaginations forward, or the thing that inspires the heart and the spirit to, like, create forth more things in the world. And I think that, you know, live action films, I could point to thousands of, you know, hundreds of films that have impacted my vision over the years. And I still love all of filmmaking and storytelling in general. But animation, more than anything, is the thing that affects your soul in a lot of ways, because it's art that has been crafted by hand, And not to say that live action hasn't been crafted by hand, but there's a tactile feel in animation mm-hmm. that you can't disabuse yourself from. And I will always defend animators and editors and craftsmen and craftspeople just working in this industry, because it is just such a special feel to it, you know. Ultimately, like, animation is you know, you're always going to, art is always going to be something that, like, anyone can do, but not everyone can excel at. And I think that is the thing that, like, is so beautiful in seeing. It's like, if you put the time and effort in, like, you're gonna come out making something amazing. So, that's one of the reasons I love animation as an art form, as a medium, and filmmaking in general, you know.
Well, I have to say, you have definitely put in the work. You have excelled at editing animation, at editing, period. But editing animation and the voice that you give to Dear Upstairs Neighbors with this pacing, with the intensity, with the calm, it's just spectacular. This is what I always... A big thing for me with films, and I've said this for decades and decades and decades, is that for me, a hallmark of a good film is when I don't need dialogue. When I can look at the images, be it animation, be it live action, and hear score, and that's all I need to know what's happening. This film did not need dialogue. Because we get the emotional beats from your cutting, we know when to calm down, when to let the heart rate slow down and lower the blood pressure, and then let it ramp up again and give it a great cardio workout. this is what excellent storytelling and filmmaking is, Sarah. You have done a wonderful job along with Connie and the rest of the team, but the editing is a real heartbeat on Dear Upstairs Neighbors.
I genuinely appreciate you saying that. It's the thousands of hours that I put on this film across the time that I've worked on it. You know, it just goes back to, like, you know, the old filmmaking of, like, Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. You know, one of my favorite films of all time is City Lights, and obviously you know, kind of just that kind of slapstick humor, but also the silent filmmaking, you know, they had to amplify the ways that they communicate ideas to an audience in a way that, you know, they just didn't have dialogue, you know, the ability to have, like, audio dialogue to help them. Like, you know, you have to think in other ways. And I try to utilize that in a way that is respectful to the story we're trying to tell, but it is... It's something where you take a big gamble. You hope that people are going to feel something when you make the things you make, and you hope that comes across the ideas you were thinking about at night, you know. And obviously, leveraging a varied, you know, array of voices in that process. And, you know, I think we had a production crew like almost 50 people on this.
Wow.
You know, and every single person had a voice in that process and a decision in that process, and everyone came together to do that. And that's a conservative crew, considering, you know, most animation shows. I mean, working on feature films, we get into the thousands. You know?
Yes, you do.
So it's you know, I think that it's something that, like, you try to do your best to communicate to people, and you hope, and you make a gamble on, like, what is going to read to them. And it means so much when you hear it from people reflected back to you, because it's validation that you knew what you were doing is right, you know. And I think that's what is the payoff in movies for me, is telling stories is one thing, you know, me making a movie is one thing. It's when the audience feels the communication of the idea that you had in your head, and not just, like, says it, but feels it in their body. That is ultimately the validation that I live for in this industry, and I think it's so important to the human experience.
I think you're going to get validated when this screens this weekend at Tribeca.
I'm so excited for it. I can't wait.
I can't wait to find out. Y'all just gonna have to tell me how the audience reacted to this one.
Oh my God, I wish I was going. Can you believe it?
Well, somebody's going to have to report to you so you can report to me.
That I can do for you, I promise.
Because this
I'll have eyes on the ground.
This short is exactly the reason why I firmly believe that we should have short films before every feature. This was one of the greatest things when I was growing up. There was always an animated short before a feature film back in the 1960s. And I really believe we need to go back to that. Because you see something like this, and you really appreciate the storytelling. So even if the feature film might be sucky, you've got a good memory coming out of it from the great animation that preceded it. So
100% agree.
Oh, Sarah, I can't thank you enough. This has been a pure delight. I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Absolutely. You are so wonderful to talk to, and I genuinely hope we get to talk again in the future as well.
You go have a great rest of your day, and Yalda, thank you for making this happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Sarah, both for your time. Debbie, you're the best, and we will be in touch.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. And that was Sarah Affleck talking about the animated gem, Dear Upstairs Neighbors, which is currently on the festival circuit. It had its world premiere at Tribeca on Saturday, and there are encore screenings. I don't have the dates in front of me. Sorry about that. So if you're in New York, check out the Tribeca Film Fest and grab a ticket to see Dear Upstairs Neighbors, as well as Roar. They have a beautifully curated animation shorts section at Tribeca that is, I think, is just absolutely wonderful. And they've got quite a few shorts in there. Oh, and I'm looking at my flipping through notes right now. And yes, like Roar, you can hear this coming, you can see this coming Saturday, the 13th as well. Saturday morning, the 13th. You can see Roar. I don't have the next screening for Dear Upstairs Neighbors, though. I don't see where I have that jotted down anywhere. My bad. So forgive me for that. But check the Tribeca website. So that is all the time we have today. I want to thank Jesse and Sarah for spending so much time talking with me about their animation shorts. Both of them are spectacular. And I still firmly believe we need to have short films in front of every film in a theater. And animation shorts are the best things to put in front of features in theaters. So theater owners need to think about that. Distributors need to think about that. So, yes, we ran long today, but for very worthy films and filmmakers. Make sure to tune in and log on next week for more interesting interviews and films. And check out the website, behindthelensonline.net, which has a number of my Emmy FYC interviews. They're now up. Plus, new reviews and interviews, including James Nunn. Sorry, I went with animation and not Hungry Hippos today. But my interview with James and my review of The Very Hungry, Hungry Hippos in Hungry, they're up on the site. And there is also my interview with director Jonathan Zuck and producer Eamon O'Rourke talking about their own Great White Shark and Chum. Yes, yes, yes. And it does have a line in the film. People apparently are tastier than cats and dogs to sharks. You got to see it. You got to see it, people. So go to the website. Check it all out. Check Tribeca. Find out when you can see these shorts and other beautiful animated shorts. Go to the Illumini Studios website to check out what all Jesse Weglin has lined up and what he's working on right now. I got tasty treats for you everywhere. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.